Hello, Blenders. On this week's episode, we have the Army of the Dead trailer. We talk F9, and we have Ben Wheatley on the show discussing his new film, In the Earth.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 160 of Real Blend, a podcast that needs to borrow a few bucks so that we can buy the Cinerama Dome, please. My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing editor here at Cinema Blend and one of the co-hosts of the Real Blend podcast. I missed you guys last week. We'll get into that in a heartbeat. On this week's show, the Army of the Dead trailer, Zack Snyder films that are not set in the DC universe. In the Earth review, we're going to be talking about a new micro-budget horror film coming from director Ben Wheatley, and we have Ben Wheatley joining the show. The show that's co-hosted every single week by myself, as I mentioned, and Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hi, Kev. How are you?
Sean, good to see you. I missed you last week as well. I'm glad that you were able to have some time with your family and take your kid on a college tour. So we did miss you, but your real boys are back this week, right?
It's highly unusual listening to the show and hearing you guys do all the fun things that we get to do every single week. Because Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago led the show and had a very funny joke. Hi, Jake.
It was pointed out to me, and now I can't unhear it.
Oh, no.
That I used my anchor voice when hosting the show.
Yeah.
And I went back and listened after it was pointed out to me by one of my best friends, one of our loyal listeners, Chase. And I think he said, I don't know how to handle this episode. Because I think I very much used my, like, hello, Blenders, and welcome. Well, you know, and I went back and tried to listen. I was like, oh, my God. I didn't talk normally the entire episode. Yeah. I used my TV voice.
The only weird part was when you said coming up next on Fox 32 is this story. I was like, where is that?
I know how to tease. I do know how to write a good tease. But I got to tell you, Sean, and I said this to the boys multiple times while we were recording everything last week. It really does give me a new appreciation for what you do on this show every week and how difficult it is, or maybe difficult is the wrong word. Definitely not easy it is to keep moving this show along. Because there were multiple moments I would try to move us on to the next topic. And maybe this is appreciating Gabe a little bit, too.
Yes.
Where I would try to, like, move us on to the next topic. And, you know, I would get... Whoa, okay, really quick. From both of the guys.
Oh, well, Gabe, at least. Gabe, say hello also.
Hello.
You were chiming in, and you were now the guilty party of, like, keeping the conversation flowing.
No, I was filling... So Kevin was filling in for me. I was filling in for Kevin.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I just kept the train rolling.
And then the thing was really wanted to, like, do this, but I know that we record the show for YouTube, so I didn't want to spend the whole time, like, kind of just, like... So we had
we got to let people know when we got off from recording, we removed Sean from the text thread, which was a big moment. Funny enough, like, jokingly, though, like, we were all texting, like, okay, all right, Sean, you're out of the show, and now Gabe's taking over. And, like, Gabe literally removed Sean from the thread. And I'm like, wait. And Sean's out there, like, going through colleges with his own son. He just looked down at his phone and sees he's been removed from the Real Blend Brothers text thread. Did you even notice that you were removed, or did you come back to it at some point?
Oh, that joke didn't land.
That's what I was wondering.
No, I was too busy. I felt bad. It was more for you, make you guys laugh. I was
laughed hard.
It was good.
It was funny, but I was wondering with Sean. I had a feeling Sean was going to miss it because by the time he got back to his phone, he was already added back into the group. So I don't even know if you missed any messages or not. So
I did blow it at one point. I wanted to take a screen grab of, like, there was a hundred and something messages back and forth between something, and then I, like, opened it, and then they went away. It's too late. All right. Anyway, if you're watching us on YouTube, hello. Good to see you guys. Go down, hit subscribe, turn on your notifications. If you're listening to us where you get your audio podcast needs, head to the description down below. It'll tell you where you can head over to the YouTube page and subscribe to our channel. We're over 3,100 subscribers. Is that right? We're over 3,000 at the very least. So thank you for building up that army. That's been helped by having a lot of really great guests who have come on board. And of course, we have the Real Blend Premium, which gives you a new episode on every Monday and a ad-free experience with your Real Blend weekly podcast. You can go to bit.ly/RealBlendPremium. Real Blend Premium, you're right, Jake. That is hard to say. To sign up for that service. And hopefully you guys will. We're going to have a really fun one this week. We're going to talk about stories for movie theaters that we really like. And we'll include some Arclight love in that. So the weekly poll. So much news going on this week that I actually forgot that this was a news item that happened. But the weekly poll that we set up is how excited are you for Indiana Jones 5? We had some casting news that we didn't get to cover on the show. Oh, I don't know. You guys didn't get a chance to talk about that on the show. Where we had Phoebe Waller-Bridge join the cast as the leading lady, although we don't know her character just yet, for the fifth Indiana Jones, which absolutely is moving forward despite the fact that Harrison Ford is 78. We had a conversation about how, well, this was in the text thread, about why Harrison Ford is doing this, and is he really doing it to kind of end on a high note, possibly recognizing that Kingdom of the Crystal Skull was not the film that he wanted it to be. I'm a little troubled because Spielberg's not in the director's seat, although I think James Mangold is a terrific filmmaker. It's going to be unusual to see anyone not named Spielberg directing an Indiana Jones film. Maybe it's the breath of fresh air that everybody, that franchise kind of needs. So we put it out to you guys. And Jake, I'm going to give it to you. Your choices are for the how excited are you for Indiana Jones 5? Can't wait, holding expectations, not interested, or there's an Indy 5?
I personally would say can't wait, but okay. I would say that the majority of people I'd like to think are excited but are apprehensive, if only because of the last film. So I would say a majority of people are maybe like holding out expectations. Or
you are very correct. 39.6% said holding expectations. A whopping 30.4% said not interested as our second highest grossing one. And then can't wait with 17.5. Kev, where are you? Where would you put it?
I mean, where do I stand personally?
Personally, yes.
I'm where our audience is.
Yeah.
I think I have apprehension about one, Spielberg not doing it. Two, the fourth one wasn't good. It's so funny. The other day I was upstairs and I was going through some of my Blu-rays, and I was watching some of the Back to the Future films, and I was like, that is such a perfect trilogy. Like, there's just three movies, and they never went away, forward in the storyline. And I kind of wish the same thing happened with Indy, to be honest with you. I think that Temple of Doom, Raiders, and Crusade are, I say what you want about Temple of Doom, I still love that movie, but there's three great movies. And I just wish Kingdom of the Crystal Skull never existed. I wish we never saw aliens in that sense. I don't think we need another Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, Jake brings up an interesting point about Harrison Ford wanting to do one more time with the character to be able to, you know, kind of give it a good send off, not have the fourth one be like the last one he did. I just don't think we need another Indiana Jones. Now, so our viewer listeners went with the idea of we'll wait and see kind of thing, right? Essentially,
yes,
we're going to see.
Holding
that's where I'm at.
Yeah.
Right. That's where I'm at, because I think, without Spielberg, it's definitely a question for me. I love James Mangold, revisited Ford vs. Ferrari recently, walked the line. He's a phenomenal filmmaker, and I think he'll handle the franchise perfectly fine. I just don't know if it's necessary. Now, we work in a business where it's equal parts commerce and equal parts, you know, art in that sense. So I think that we have to understand that this is definitely a business move, but I hope that Mangold and Ford are doing it for the story reasons. That's kind of what I'm hoping for. So that's where I'm at now. I love Phoebe Waller-Bridge. She's a great addition to the cast. I'm kind of in that same boat as a viewer, as listeners.
Part that scares me the most about it is just that they had a release date for this and a title while they were still sort of like juggling screenwriters.
Yeah.
Which doesn't say to me that they had an idea, you know, that was like, oh, well, this is it. This is the reason why we have to do Indy 5, right? Like, someone came up with an idea. They were like, let's do Indy 5. And then who has an idea for it? Like, it's kind of reverse engineered. So,
but in a weird way, doesn't Harrison Ford's age dictate what the story can and cannot be? Because
100%.
Because, you know, a big reason that aside from George Lucas's involvement, that Aliens in Area 51 was, you know, the story of Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, is that's kind of a little bit of like what the conversation was around that time. And so I'd imagine that as Ford has gotten older, which dictates when the movie has to take place. I think someone did the math, and at this point, aren't they saying in the 70s?
Yeah, that's so kind of crazy.
Which is weird, the idea. So pretty soon, Indiana Jones will be able to see Star Wars.
It's kind of crazy.
But just the idea. So I think that's also an interesting thing, too, is that like that the story is ever evolving depending on how old Harrison Ford is. I think my concern is he, and they touched on it, but not as much as I would have liked them to. They have to address how old he is. Because I felt like one of my biggest complaints about Crystal Skull wasn't that, you know, aside from the aliens and everything, but like you have Harrison who can barely run, to be honest with you. Like he's always been an awkward runner, and then you multiply that awkward run by age, and then you cut to a stunt double swinging on his whip, like something that like a 30-year-old could barely do, and it was just so jarring. And there were a couple of jokes about his age and stuff like that, but I feel like they really have to straight up just be honest and go like, look, we know he's 80, and that's kind of a part of the story.
I just don't know if this is a good idea. I just don't know if I want this.
What's the worst that could happen?
I mean, it could make a bad movie.
Yeah, but at least don't you want to see him one more time and hear that theme? And John Williams is coming back.
That is cool.
Question that... it comes out of nowhere. I have no reason to believe this, but is a fun thing to speculate. How much do you think the pedigree of Logan either is going to influence Mangold's direction or influence the hiring of Mangold for this kind of what I assume would be a sunsetting story?
He's going to impale Indy on a tree branch?
I don't know, but I just mean like how much do you think?
And as like a little girl walks away, she's going to hang the fedora.
But you know how producers think. Again, like I said, it's kind of sure. But you know how producers think, and how much were people like, you know, he really put in a finite or a fine point on the end of Wolverine storyline.
Okay,
we want Mangold to do that for us within Indy.
Yeah,
I don't know. Maybe he has some really great way to
not
do
terrible.
That.
Is Indy gonna die in this one?
I don't think Disney would. I don't think Disney would let him do it.
I mean, no, they killed Han Solo.
I don't think he dies. I think he gets. No, I know. What I hate about it is that he legitimately has a ride off into the sunset scene. Like, you don't script a better ending for a franchise. And then they came back.
But maybe it's going to be a franchise where we can all universally agree that the odd number films are great and the even number ones suck.
But Temple of Doom's amazing, so it doesn't work.
You're mispronouncing the word sucks.
Incredible.
No,
Temple of Doom's great.
Fantastic. Might be my favorite.
Yeah, it's
I will agree that Temple of Doom is more Kingdom of the Crystal Skull than it is Raiders, but it's still great.
The fact that you think that that's the best opening? I think Nuke Fridge is better than the opening of Temple of Doom.
No,
the musical
opening
of Temple. I think the Anything Goes opening from Temple of Doom is horrible. And
it's amazing.
It's literally in a club named after a Star Wars character, and I do not. It goes Boulder, Young Indy, Nuked Fridge.
As soon as he brings Star Wars into it, I check out. It's all right.
I'm saying because it's called Club Obi-Wan.
But who cares?
Nothing in Crystal Skull is better than Temple of Doom.
Yes, true.
Nothing is better than Nothing
there
in
is
Crystal
no
Skull.
There is no memorable scene from Crystal Skull.
There are moments of Crystal Skull. That moment where they're in the warehouse and they knock into one of the boxes and it shows like the Ark of the Covenant. Like that's fun.
Lazy.
You're lazy.
I'm a little strange because, well, you guys know that already, but I'm a little strange in the sense that I think Crusade's the best one. And I've said that before.
That's a great, and also the chemistry between him and Connery is just.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with that.
It's kind of the reason why I love Die Hard 3 the most as well, because I like those team ups and those partnerships and like, you know, and I think we discussed this in our premium episode last week about like kind of like action movies, buddy cop action movies and things like that. But Temple of Doom, for me, hands down, out of the trilogy, has my favorite opening. And I just love that movie. I just, now that we're talking about it and going more and more into discussion, I'm starting to go more towards the other way on this. I'm like, I don't know if we need this movie. I'm a fan of this. I love John Williams, love Mangold, love Ford.
You know, I think you can choose.
This is a bad idea.
you can choose not interested and know that you're still going to see it. Like, of course you're going to see it.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that you're like, you might not even get excited, you know, as it's coming up.
I have a question for you guys. And this is a genuine question. I'm not trying to like, because you guys are Temple of Doom fans.
Yes.
Why is Temple of Doom a prequel to Raiders?
We're called Doomers. Okay.
Sorry. Temple of Doomers. Why is Doom a prequel? Like, why did they decide that that's the direction they wanted to go? Because Temple of Doom takes place before Raiders of the Lost Ark.
It does. But I don't know why.
I'm curious as to why. I'm sure there's an answer out there. I'm sure it's a quick Google away.
Yeah, I don't know.
Temple of Doom has some of my favorite action scenes in the franchise.
Temple of Doom is great.
Yeah, the minecar chase fight at the end is unbelievably great.
I will say this, and I know we have to move on, and everyone I think knows this already, but the PG-13 rating was created because of that film, essentially. Yeah. That was one of the, right, and that heart scene is still brutal. Like, it's brutal. Still holds
also,
up.
Also, I don't like Short Round.
I like Short Round.
Well, now you're crazy.
I like Short Round.
Try to tell me that Mutt Lang, or Mutt whatever his last name is a better character than Short Round.
No.
Please try to say that.
See, Jake, me growing up, Short Round, I was Short Round. Like, for me, like, Short Round was like who I identified
you're
with.
You're actually
of, like,
wearing
right
a
down
Yankee
to the
hat
Yankee
right
cap.
Now.
Yeah,
yeah.
The Yankee cap.
Yeah. Wait, Jake, are you saying that Crystal Skull is better than Temple of Doom?
No,
Jesus
stop
Christ.
It.
Throw
just
to the interview, please. Let's get out of here.
Okay,
let's get out of here before they cancel our show.
On this week's episode, we have...
Jake is seriously thinking about this.
Director Ben Wheatley, who people know from such amazing films as High Rise, and he'd recently directed the Rebecca remake with Armie Hammer. We did not get into Armie Hammer in this conversation, but we did talk about, this is a micro-budget horror film that I mentioned earlier in the film, in the podcast, that he wrote in 15 days while he was in quarantine, and it's very much reflective of that. You can listen to this without having seen it. We don't get into any kind of spoilers. It's a film that Neon is putting out very soon. Again, it's called In the Earth. And so without further ado, Ben Wheatley on the Real Blend Podcast. How you doing, Ben?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. I appreciate you taking the time to join the Real Blend Podcast. We are thrilled to have you on and talk about this crazy film. It kind of had the Jaws effect for me, in that I'm fairly certain I'm never going to go into the woods again after having watched this. I'm curious if you are the type of person who viewed the woods or forests as ominous places before even starting down this path.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, when I was a little kid, we lived next to woods, and I've had reoccurring nightmares about woods. I mean, you know, I'm happy as anyone to walk around in the woods. I'm not afraid. I'm not like a city person who's like, no, you know, that side of it. I think the kind of actual physical woodland thing is not a problem, but the metaphoric kind of space that it has in my head, I am afraid of, yeah.
But then to that extent, does it make for a difficult shoot? Because you're immersed in it constantly. Like, the day ends and you're still there.
Yeah, but I've made films about people shooting each other in warehouses, and I don't get terrified about warehouses. You know what I mean?
Is this an idea? Like, did you have the concept of this idea for a long time, or was it truly something that was birthed out of being in quarantine for a while?
Yeah, it was like the second week, basically, of the lockdown in the UK, I started writing it. And I think it's, you know, I looked at all the scripts I'd written up until that point, and I thought that kind of like drew a line in the sand and, like, you know, mourned their passing, but they were gone, you know, and it was a new reality. So I kind of, and I did it as a sort of like a therapy thing to start with, of like something to do, just to kind of get my, to make myself feel a bit more alive, you know, a bit more useful. So it was weird that first week. I almost felt like that was it. You know, I was retired or something, and that was the end of I'll never work again kind of thing, or that the industry was completely a wasteland. But yeah, and then I just did it as a thing of trying to work out what I was feeling, you know, and it kind of went from there.
Have those fears about the industry sort of faded away, or do you still hold on to them a little bit? Because I think we're all sort of in a period where we're figuring out how to move forward.
Yeah, well, the industry itself has been in a tailspin since it was invented. You know, it's gone from crisis to crisis, you know. And yeah. So, you always take the end of cinema with a pinch of salt. But yeah, I mean, it's particularly difficult. But this story is moving very, very quickly, isn't it? It's changing and mutating all the time in terms of what's going to happen. I mean, who knows what will how the cinema audiences will return. They seem to be getting stronger as it goes on in the last couple of weeks, and that's exciting. And you know, and maybe it's like a clean slate for everybody, and they come back with a different set of expectations of what they want to watch, and you know, it's a restart or not, or maybe it's something completely different. I don't know yet.
Well, there's a line in the film that sort of hit me where they say, like, we are going to forget what happened and we're just going to go back to our norms. And I do sort of wonder, like, how close we're going to be getting back to that, and whether we'll be able to just sort of embrace the way things used to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think after the Spanish flu, there was 10 years of upheaval, wasn't there, before things kind of settled down. So I think that you just don't know. You just don't know how it's going to, what's going to happen, really.
What was the reaction to the creatives that you pulled in to work with you on this project? Were they all still chomping at the bit and trying to, like, just waiting for the next project to come around?
Yeah, well, everyone had been stood down. You know, it'd been 4 months of nothing, and everybody's projects had been cancelled. Everything had stopped. It was an incredible thing, like that. But that first week, remember that kind of hearing about that it was going into lockdown on the Friday, and just every future was kind of dimmed and turned off. And so when I got in contact with people about making this, people were, you know, there was almost like concern about, are we going to be too, have we become too enfeebled to actually do the physical work of lumping boxes around and stuff, and you know, doing a proper job that's not painting the kitchen or just looking out the window, you know?
Right. And what about some of the cautions of being a story that is, not that you're commenting on, you know, either the COVID disease or the idea of quarantine, but like dancing close enough to it that you want to be timely, but you don't want to be dated, kind of thing. How did you wrestle with that?
Well, I'd made a film before called Happy New Year, Colin Bursted, which was very time sensitive. But in a way, all the other movies have been as well. You know, Kill This certainly was, and it was about that moment and the economic crash at the time. And, you know, so I think that my instinct is always to make stuff that's in the moment. I mean, it's a particularly heavy moment at the moment, but it wasn't an unusual thing. You know, over the last 3 or 4 years, I've made films that in between the kind of larger budget things, which are a bit more nimble and about what was going on at the time. So it wasn't that odd. I mean, and also it's not specifically about COVID, so it doesn't have that thing of kind of piggybacking onto COVID in a way, but it's more, I always thought about it, it's just something that's set now, you know, that it's just contemporary, you know. Mm-hmm.
I made the mistake of trying to eat while watching the film. I realized about an hour in, that was a mistake. I would like for you to, if you could, just talk a little bit about some of the prosthetic work that goes into Joel Fry, your leading man. His foot goes through the ringer. Let's just put it that way, because I want to protect some of the secrets. But you do some extremely credible, what I will call backyard surgery, let's say.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like the fourth or fifth film I've worked with Dan Martin, who's the prosthetics designer on this film, and he also did Possessor more recently, and Color Out of Space as well. He worked on that as well. So he's an amazing technician and an artist. And I kind of, I'd forgotten how much I enjoy prosthetic work, you know, and just to see people in the on set just going, oh my God. And the uncanny valleyness of it all, of just seeing these things, you know, they look absolutely real, these things. I mean, absolutely real. And then you touch it and you go, oh, maybe it's not. But you find it very difficult. Your brain, there's a total dissonance between your brain and your eyes, you know, when you see the effects work.
What about for your actor, though? What kind of situation does it put him in?
Well, I mean, as a technical role for Joel Fry, the performance of pain is really hard, because you've got to look at the the range of pain across a film. You know, you don't want to peak too early with your pain. It's like, how do you know? And all these things, it's like so easy to write on the plastic piano. You know, you're kind of going like this and you write this stuff and then someone's got to interpret it. And I was just, you know, that was just an incredible joy watching him work it out, you know. And you just, I have find that I've got, have a real problem on set, which is like a kind of weird empathy thing of like, you see people who are like have injuries on them or are acting like they're in pain and you kind of naturally go, oh God, oh, maybe we shouldn't carry on. And, and it's like, so you have to kind of, or you end up doing less takes than you'd want to because you're worried that they're hurt or something. So there's a weird line there, but then I guess that's because it's working, you know.
Yes, absolutely. And you're trying to get the best out of him from what he needs for that part of the story. So
yeah.
There's a lot of trust, actually, too, that he has to put into new characters that he meets along the way. And I found that to be something that sort of kept the audience off guard. Can you talk about your decisions about how to parcel off? There's a lot of mysteries being told in the story, and the audience is frequently questioning, you know, what we're seeing and what we can trust. Can you talk a bit about how you decided over the course of the story to sort of parcel out what was going to be coming next?
Yeah, I mean, I think the trust thing is, we did wrestle with it a bit in the script, going, oh, you know, would you trust someone that you met in the woods, blah, 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 you know. But the problem is that it's pragmatism most of the time. It's like if you take very small baby steps towards very bad decisions quite readily when you're hungry or that you're vulnerable in some way or another. So I looked and thought, you know, and Joel Fry's character is mainly based on me in terms of the level of uselessness and cowardice that he displays, you know, throughout the thing. I think, what would I do in these situations? Yes, I would do whatever I was told to get out of this situation, whatever it was. And if someone suggested they were going to do something that something needed surgery, I wouldn't put up any kind of a fight, you know. And I think that it's only in movies that people are so gung-ho or so aware of their own situation that they will fight back, I think, you know. And I've seen it in actual situations, in fights in pubs and in on the street and stuff, and people become very supplicant very quickly when confronted with violence or anyone who's like slightly convincing, you know, and they'll do anything, you know. So I think that side of it was the thinking behind it, basically.
Is he one of the first characters you've written that closely mirrors yourself, or do you try to put a little bit of yourself into each of your characters?
I don't think you have any choice. You try not to, is what the plan is, so that they don't all speak with the same voice, but inevitably they become the same person once you've got a bit of distance from them.
I guess that makes sense as well, too. I have a technical question for you. We are a technical podcast that really likes to dive into the gimmicks of filmmaking and the tricks of filmmaking. And you do something that was truly incredible from a visual standpoint of using a strobe light effect. And I won't talk about the context of it, but you get striking images when shooting into a strobe light effect. And it you don't lose any clarity. You don't lose any depth of focus. I'm really truly curious, like, how that works. How are you able to shoot into strobe light and not have it distort the image that you're trying to capture?
I don't know. I mean, you know, a strobe light itself is a photographic tool for fashion photography, isn't it? Kind of. So, and concerts, but mainly it comes from like the strobe lights all being connected together and then used to fire instantaneously when you take a photograph instead of having to completely fill your studio with light. So, you know, that you set the exposure to somewhere that's close to what the strobe light is, and then everything else is slightly darker. So that's the way you can control them. But I mean, we did things inside the editing where sometimes there, in long sequences, there's flash frames of images on every cut. So that join the whole sequence together, which you don't necessarily notice on first viewing. And then we started finding that if you put like a frame of sound next to a frame of a flash frame, then you could immediately see it. But you could have one frame that had a noise on it and then one that didn't right next to it, and you wouldn't see the second frame.
Really?
So you might see it on multiple viewings depending on the how your eyes were blinking. And you'll probably see it more in the cinema than you would see it on your home system or on your laptop or whatever. So So yeah, there was a lot of that. A lot of that went on, but mainly the strobes were involved in it because I wanted to make. And the same thing with the music is that I wanted the sound and the light to be embedded into the script of the into the story of the film rather than being an effect. So Dr. Wendell uses strobe lights to communicate with the plants, which justifies them being in the film, you know. So then you've all of a sudden you can have them everywhere, and then that's then that becomes an aesthetic, you know.
Oh, it really was. I think coming out of one of the strobe light sequences too is when a character uses a flare, and I thought that the visual of the flare, the light that it cast, and the smoke caught in it was so vibrant and beautiful at that point. It was a really truly beautiful shot.
Yeah, they're incredible, those flares. They're so bright. I mean, we use them to on Rebecca. We use them to light stuff, light whole houses up with flares. And they're, you know, I don't know, they're £10 each or something like that, and they last for ages. So they're an instant kind of, and they come in lots of colors as well. It's great.
Yeah, it's awesome. You know, a lot of people are going to be looking at a film like this as we try to figure out our way through on-set protocols, and you know, trying to figure out the right way to shoot things and changing the way the films are shot. I think you talked about when you said that you threw away some scripts or that you lamented their passing. Is it because you've written stuff that it's just going to be too difficult to shoot moving forward, or?
No, I think it's more to do with like a general shift in society having gone through lockdown. And I think everyone's different. Everyone's changed, you know, and I think that the stories and all the ideas from before all feel a bit dated and everything needed to be refreshed. From my own work, I don't know, I can't speak for anybody else, but you're right in some ways. I mean, you couldn't. The film that we shot at the budget that we shot it, we couldn't have shot an indoor, like an intimate piece of four people or five people in rooms because of it was crazy expensive to do that at that point. You have to have these kind of on-set fogging machines and antiseptic fog that cleans all the surfaces, and everything would have to be washed all the time. Whereas if you make a film that's outdoors, then the transmission rate is virtually zero. So you can, even though we all wore masks during it and observe very strict protocol across the whole thing, but you're much safer outside than you would be indoors. I don't know if that's the same now, but that when we made the film, it was that.
Well, I'm curious. I'm going to shift then to this point because I think I'm under the impression that you're about to go into a really big budget franchise. Are you still directing The Meg 2? Are you prepping that? Yeah. Is that getting, you know, like, do you have to get closer to the way things used to be done? Or are you sort of adapting to the new normal as you take on a big franchise like that?
I don't know. I mean, I think that obviously everything changes month by month. So it could be very different. It could be like no, nothing, or it could be everything. I don't know yet. So, but to go back to In the Earth, the actual wearing of masks and the following of protocol wasn't that bad in the end. It was we shot as fast as we would normally shoot. It didn't impede on production in any way. It was just a bit more, you know, that we ended up spending quite a lot of money on PPE. But apart from that, it didn't seem to really affect how the film was made, which I was really relieved about because we did a test day and it was a bit like, you know, the masks were a bit much and it was all a bit claustrophobic. But when we shot the film, like that second day in, didn't make any difference. It was fine. Good.
I hope that continues to be the case for both yourself and a ton of other artists that move forward. I hope that you can bring prosthetics to The Meg. That's the only thing I ask. Please bring more prosthetics work and really, really gory, gritty stuff to that. I want to drill down on the concept of a Parnag Feg. Where did it come from? And specifically, who did that sketch for you? There's a terrific sketch that almost like illustrates the legacy of Parnag Feg. Where did that come from?
Well, the drawing is, well, it's like a print, but it's, by Richard Wells, and I'd come across him because he did a poster for A Field in England, one of the films we made a few years ago, and we saw it online and loved it, and we and Andy Stark, the producer, and I contacted Richard and said, oh, can we make some of these and give them out and stuff, and he was like, yeah. So that was the beginning of our relationship with him. And then basically when I was writing this, I thought, well, this post, it has to be done by him, really. So I contacted him again and he was like, oh my god, yeah. But he does, you know, he works in props anyway, so and does graphic design for cinema, so he knew the score. But Pan Egg Fig itself is made up, you know, thoroughly made up by me. And within the context of the movie, there's, it's kind of, how made up is it in terms of like the world of folkloric tales is up for grabs, you know. It's, and that's the thing I've found, like, over looking into this stuff, is like sometimes things that look like they're really old aren't that old, or they're like Victorian or something like that, or they're 1850s or something, or even the 70s, you know. And I think that that kind of shifting sands of that, it kind of feels like history but it isn't history, was interesting. And it's like, and the Zach character is kind of, he's pushing this story, but how true is the story? You don't really know, you know. But then at this, in the base of all stories, there's a seed of truth. And so how, you know, the spirit of the woods thing may be like a, you know, a big gussied up version of people interacting with what really is there, you know.
Was that the kernel of the seed of the story? Was it the folk tale, or what? Like, I'm curious, like, where a character like Zach comes in the development of the story. You know, do you start with something that builds off of the fable, and then you're like, oh, well, then I need a human element to bring in. Where does someone like Zach come in?
I can't remember. I think it was like the whole thing seemed to kind of come in one piece, and it was a journey, you know, it's their journey into the wood, into the center of the story, you know. Mm-hmm. And like the demarcation, what was it, AU 357 or whatever that she says at the beginning, is the actual folkloric reference number for the study of stories based around Hansel and Gretel. So their story is the Hansel and Gretel story, you know. They kind of dropped into the woods, and then they end up in Zach is basically, you know, kind of the gingerbread house woman, or like, or the kind of, you know, a poisoner who will kill children and all this kind of stuff. So it's like the whole journey of it was like going through different types of horror, through different types of science fiction, you know. So you have this kind of maniac in the woods story, and you also, which is like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre story in a way, and then you have, you know, body horror, but then you end up in a kind of more 70s science fiction world of like a Tom Baker Doctor Who world, or a kind of Quatermassy world, you know. And so that was, and I don't know, I just, it was like a journey through my kind of my interest in horror, really.
No, it's quite a ride. It's absolutely quite a ride. And to that end, and I'll get you out of here on this one. As your career progresses, I've watched you take on bigger projects and take on more high profile projects. And I think that's truly thrilling. But I love that you just went back to your roots and told this sort of stripped down story, because it was interesting to you. Is that something that's going to be really important to you? Are you always going to try to keep a foot in, you know, every once in a while, I'm going to come back and just tell a stripped down basic story to keep your skills sharp?
Yeah, for sure. And it's, I really love making films. So if you make a decision that you're only going to make like high budget stuff, then you just don't make that many films. That's the sadness of it, you know? And I love these kinds of movies. I mean, a lot of the thing that how this film had come about also was like by finding paperwork about the production of Halloween and going, oh wow, it's like a 3-week shoot. Or 4 weeks, just about, but it's not that long, and the budget is comparable to the budget that we had in adjusted dollars. And thinking, well, this is the bedrock of horror and the bedrock of a lot of genre cinema. But these movies weren't like $200 million. They weren't 3.5 hours long. They were mean and lean, and you know, and they were done with love and grit, you know, and that was inspiring. And I thought, well, I'll, you know, if we can make a masterpiece like Halloween for that, then we should at least be able to do something all right, you know.
That's fascinating. You kind of strip down what worked about Halloween, right? And how do you get to the essence of what makes it scary? You know, it's not because they're pouring money into it. It's because they get to the core of what.
Well, it's attitude, isn't it? It's attitude. It's Carpenter's attitude, and he wants to scare you, and he doesn't. He, you know, he's not going to hold your hand, and he's going to, you know, and I think that comes through, and it comes through in all his movies in a way.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. Thank you, Ben. I really appreciate your time. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you very much to Neon for giving us time with Ben Wheatley. His movie is coming out into select theaters this Friday, and we will get into a review of it later in the show.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Let's get to talking points. A lot of trailers for things that are coming down the pipeline soon. We're going to start with Zack Snyder's Army of the Dead. This is Zack's return to the zombie genre, although it's not connected in any way to his Dawn of the Dead that he released. I think that was his first film. Was Dawn of the Dead Zack Snyder's first film? I think that's correct.
It was definitely his first major feature, because that was 2004, I believe that was. And that was actually the first time, I mean, I'll just personally, Snyder got on my radar.
Yeah.
Because I was apprehensive walking into Dawn of the Dead because, you know, clearly Dawn of the Dead is an iconic horror film that we all know, and George Romero is a genius. And I remember leaving Dawn of the Dead going, I think that was a better film than what Romero did. And again, it wouldn't exist without Romero. So sure. You can't really, it's a hard thing to say. But to be honest with you, I think it might have been the first time I ever heard Snyder's name. I don't know, Gabe, did you look it
up? It was his first feature film.
Okay.
Did he DP Dawn of the Dead?
Let me take a look.
Well, he DPs this.
No, he did not. This was the first feature he's
And this is the first movie he shoots on digital, too. It's for Netflix, but it's going to come to theaters in May, 1 week before it goes to the streaming service. I am of the mindset that zombie movies in general are tired. I'm open to seeing a new zombie movie for sure, but I think that they need some more of a gimmick beyond just it's a zombie movie. And Zack absolutely has an amazing gimmick here, and he's cut an incredible trailer. It's obviously a casino heist film set in the middle of a zombie apocalypse or a zombie breakout that has been contained to Las Vegas. I thought it looked amazing. Jakey, what did you think of it?
I thought that was one of the most well-edited trailers I've seen in a long time. I mean, like, you know, Snyder is always known for his great song choice. Beautiful song choice for the trailer.
Yeah.
And just when it really kicks in and just, it's a sign of a good trailer when throughout the day I'll just kind of be sitting there going, I'm going to watch it again. And I've watched it. Now, granted, I don't think I watch them as often as Kevin McCarthy watches them. But I've watched it three times already, and it's just a great blend. It just looks fun. It just looks like, you know, the editing to that particular song, and then just the action looks like a blast. And it's just, there are some movies, and I think to a certain degree, maybe this was like you with Godzilla versus Kong, Sean, like where it's just the plot is just so ridiculous where you just go like, just screw it. I'm in. I'm so in. Like, it's Ocean's, like, you know, and it's got such a great elevator pitch. It's Ocean's 11, like, with zombies. Like, cool. I'm in. Yeah. Like, done. Sold.
I also love that Dave Bautista is his main actor, but it honestly looks like a true ensemble. Like, everyone in it, all the characters that get introduced look like they have something really cool and unique and different about them. The guy, Matthias, whose last name, I'm not quite sure what it is, he's playing a safecracker. Apparently Zack loved him so much that he created another movie, like a prequel movie that explains who this guy is and what sets him up for this film. Kev, you're a huge Snyder fan. Where does this sort of fall on your radar in terms of your anticipation?
Incredible. I mean, I it's so funny because like you expect it to be good because it's Snyder, and then you watch it and it's like, oh my God, that was incredible. Like the trailer, like Jake was saying, the editing is unreal. And there's that shot of, Batista walking over the tables as he's like firing. I'm like, it was awesome. I read something, and I don't want to derail this, but one of the actors in the movie shot post production, and then they digitally put her into the movie. Did you hear about this? Well,
they had to replace Chris D'Elia. Chris D'Elia was a supporting actor in it.
What's the story? Yeah,
he got wrapped up in a scandal. I don't know his full scandal, but it was pretty. I forget the details of it, but it was pretty bad, and Zack had to remove him. And so I think it's Tig Notaro who's in. Or was Tig Notaro in the movie beforehand? I forget.
Sounds right, Sean.
Okay. Yeah. Then she reshot his parts, and they
so she's composited into the shots, basically.
Honestly, I could not tell. Like, I
no.
Yeah,
I didn't know that. But there were just a handful of shots of her in the trailer, but...
Although, this is a director who we talked to who said, I shot this in my driveway.
In my driveway, right.
So,
right.
He clearly has the technical skills to pull stuff like this off.
I will say, though, Tig, though, I mean, she is featured pretty prominently in the trailer. I remember seeing her face show up a few times. And then, I read a tweet today that she did not shoot in normal production and was added in post. And that's why I was, like, questioning. I'm like, wait a second. That looks really good, like, compositing. Like, how did they pull that off so, like, naturally? That being said, though, like, I mean, it's a phenomenal trailer, and I think I was blown away just by the whole scope of it, the scale of it. It felt, I mean, the whole idea of him DPing it, I feel like I could see Snyder on the set just running around with the camera and getting those awesome shots, and, like, it felt like it had such an insane immersive energy to it, but it also felt massive. Like, there is a scale and scope of this thing that is gigantic, and... I was, you know, as the trailer continued to play out and I was more immersed into the world, I'm very interested in his digital choice. And I was wondering if that was more of just him playing around with trying to get shots more immersive, I guess it might. If you watch the go ahead.
My first thought, I'm sure it's several reasons. I'm sure you don't do something for one reason. But because he was also shooting it, speed is probably was a big factor of being able to just pick up a camera and shoot, being able to just redo a take and not having to wait for things because he has to run both departments essentially.
Yeah.
I would imagine that was a big factor of just the speed and the convenience of digital, especially on something smaller.
John,
I wonder if
what
it's
did you see on the set?
Netflix.
You saw the digital red camera, right?
I saw the red cameras, yeah, that he was shooting. And the stuff that we were watching him shoot was very intimate. It was in the casino that had been dressed like a zombie apocalypse, but it was an up close shot with Dave Bautista. And so he only
was he like
kind of
handheld up.
Yes,
that's it feels very handheld. That's kind of what I was like as the trailer opened. Like I could tell I in a weird way. And I don't mean this. I mean this in the best way possible. I feel like I could feel Snyder shooting it.
Yeah.
And I know that might be like, a suspension of disbelief thing, or you shouldn't be taken out of the world. To me, it's part of it. Like Snyder is such a visual storyteller that I'm just kind of watching him paint his
I feel that way.
Painting. Yeah.
Like when I watch like a Scorsese film, like if I watch Casino or Goodfellas, like to me, like I know, I feel like Scorsese's basically holding the camera.
Right.
Scorsese should have put a zombie into Casino. That would have been interesting. I would have
shaken things up. He put several of them in The Irishman.
Oh man.
Yeah,
and
the
that's
shot
why
that
we didn't get Scorsese on the show.
The shot that we were watching him do was Batista and someone else. I forget who it was. I think it's the girl who plays the wolf is her character. She's the one who's able to get them through the wall into Vegas. They are like in a corridor, a very dark corridor, and they're loading up their guns. And Snyder is behind them shooting into the casino kind of thing. And they are completely shadowed, and you would just see he kept sending zombie extras running through the casino floor. So you just see them in the background that they are just like crisscrossing. Zombie extras are running through the casino as these guys are talking about how they're going to get to the other side of the room and kind of like arming up. So Snyder was literally like right next to Batista, you know, in the dark shadow shooting. And then they have to like come out of the shadow and sort of turn. And we watched them do that like 27 times.
Did you forgive me if you posted this already, but I know it's common practice to like getting sort of a cool posed photo on set. Did you get one from that set?
Clay Enos shot a picture of us at a card table. Yes. And the card table has skeletons laying on it.
Oh.
And we got to like hold cards and pretend that we were playing at the casino.
Oh, I love that.
Lord knows if I'll ever see it. I don't know if I'm ever going to see it. I was just talking to one of the other guys who was on the set today. And he was like, have you heard anything about an embargo? And I'm like, I honestly think that they forgot we went. This was like October of 2019. Yeah. You know, and normally you'd hear from the studio at this point, they'd have a coordinated thing, but it was Netflix, and Netflix produces so many things that I think they probably forgot that they sent us there. So,
by the way, Tig Notaro is actually trending on Twitter right now.
Really?
As we're talking about her. Yeah. Like, wow. She, like, if you go to Twitter, People are like,
got a big following.
People are just big like comedian. Going crazy about her in the movie. Netflix put a tweet out of her like looking awesome, and then fans are just like saying they can't wait to see it because of her. So maybe that was a really interesting thing to think about. The person who was not in the original production is the actor who's trending on Twitter right now. That's pretty cool.
I will say a cool before we move on. In our interview with Snyder, he mentions that the nightmare sequence at the end of his cut of Justice League, he says it feels more Army of the Dead. He was kind of in that mode, and he said he was using that camera or that lens. Mm-hmm. And if you take this trailer and take the nightmare sequence and watch them back to back, you can 100% see what he's talking about with the way it's focused, kind of the way it's all framed, and how close he is to everybody.
Both, there's a shot of a zombie in this trailer and then of the Joker in the nightmare sequence where they like walk into or lean into the focus, which
I don't know if anyone cares about that. I love kind of seeing that. Like if you look at, you know, the rest of Justice League, where he was a few years ago versus kind of the vibe that he's in now, it's kind of cool to see.
And there's a name for that. There's a name for that camera. Cause I saw somebody use it on social and I forget what it's called.
Didn't Snyder tell us that he shot that Justice League scene digitally?
Yeah, yeah, like he was using the lenses and everything from Army. Yeah.
Well, because he couldn't get the lens from Abrams, for God's sakes. No one wouldn't go get that Star Wars lens from him.
Guys, I have a question for you. Are we getting Snyder back?
Yes, I think we're definitely going to get Snyder back.
Do you actually think we're getting Snyder back?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I think so. I think he's going to be thrilled to go around and do Army press because
he's going to do a lot more Army press than he has Justice League press.
Oh, yeah, 100%. I think he's going to be super psyched to talk about this.
So. Didn't he say in our interview that he'd come back for Army of the Dead?
Yes, he did say that. Now, of course, they all say that. But Tarantino is someone who actually lived up to it. So we're going to get to Tarantino a little bit when we talk about the Arclight. Let's get to the Fast 9 trailer. Jake, you did not see the Fast 9 trailer. Is that correct? I'm asking. I'm not pointing it out. So Kevin and I can talk about this. And this is going to screen after, or it's going to air after we are under embargo and we can now talk about it. This is the latest trailer for F9, which, Kev, did you do that press conference? You did the press conference. Mm-hmm. Did you notice that Vin Diesel kept calling it F10.1 and 10.2?
Here's how I read that. I thought that they were going to make a 10th movie and split it into two. Did he mean that this was 10.1?
I thought what you thought first also, but then the second time I swear he called this movie 10.1.
I'm sorry, these movies should not be this complicated. They shouldn't be this complicated.
I think it's cool how complicated they are. Because what is the linear order of the, because it doesn't go like 1, 2 and then like 6, 3, 4. It's like it's all over the place in terms of linear.
I know Tokyo Drift is
before 7.
Prequel,
right?
I wish I knew. Someone's got to figure out the linear. Well, anyway, let's talk about this trailer. I thought it looked like a lot of fun. I honestly do think that Justin Lin is a filmmaker who really understands this world. We had a very long conversation in the text this week with a lot of texts shared where the show sort of splits between, I think Kevin and I both appreciate the fact that I think the franchise knows exactly what it is. And I think that it delivers.
But my question that I pitched to you guys when we were having this text discussion, okay, maybe the franchise knows what it is. Maybe even the director knows what it is. And we know what it is.
Yes.
Does Vin Diesel understand what this franchise is?
Well,
yes. And that's my. I don't think. Well, you. Well, Kevin, you and I have different definitions of what this franchise is.
But I actually think Dominic Toretto is a good character, like a really well-rounded, really, really, really well-rounded character.
The only thing well-rounded about him is the shape of his head.
No, I think Toretto is actually a 20-year legacy character that I think is very interesting.
What movies are you watching?
Dom's not even a triangle. Like, he doesn't even have three sides,
let alone the rounded. I couldn't disagree more with you guys. I am so in on the characters, the family. I was watching Furious 7 again last night, and just like every scene, I care about Tyrese and Ludacris's character. I care about Paul Walker's character, obviously. I care about Jordana Brewster. I care about Michelle Rodriguez and Vin Diesel's character. I am all in. Hold on.
But all like, in. So a few years ago, Vin Diesel made a comment that he genuinely thought that like one of the Fast movies should have won Best Picture.
And Furious 7.
Truly, truly believed that.
First of all, the Russo brothers also said that Robert Downey Jr. deserved to win Best Actor for Endgame. I mean, people say that about their own movies.
I think that there's a much better case for Robert Downey Jr. getting an Oscar nomination for what he did for Iron Man.
Wait a second. You think he deserved an Oscar for Endgame?
It's more likely than Fast.
It would have been a career. Yeah, it would have been what he accomplished. Yeah.
Yeah. I love Downey Jr. Don't get me wrong. He's a phenomenal Iron Man. And I would let have a conversation at some point later on about how those movies should be considered for Academy Awards. But Vin Diesel saying that is the same thing as the Russo brothers saying that Tom Holland deserves an Oscar for Cherry or Downey Jr. deserves an Oscar for Endgame.
Also,
People say that about their movies.
Vin talks in superlatives. Like Vin is on a level up here that I think is what makes him sort of bizarrely charming. Like I agree with you. About him.
I don't think he's I don't find what he says to be like over the top to a point where he's making people feel uncomfortable about like, oh, this should win Best Picture. I think he just really feels passionate about the work. I really do. But yeah, get back to the trailer.
Right, let's get back to the trailer. Is kind of action-packed and leans heavily into the role of John Cena as younger brother Toretto, Jacob Toretto. One of the things that I'm confused about this one is that it feels like it's including a lot of people. Like, the main core cast is there. I saw Helen Mirren was there, and I remember that she's like, that she had been introduced at one point. She's one of the Shaws, right?
She's Statham and Statham's mom. Yeah.
Was she in prison last time we saw her?
She was in prison in Fast 8.
Okay.
Yes, and I don't know how she got out, but yes.
Okay. Yeah. So and then Charlize Theron. Like, this is a type of franchise where you see Charlize Theron in a trailer. She doesn't.
Was she
even
in prison
get...
in Hobbs and Shaw? She was in prison in Hobbs and Shaw.
Is that what it is?
That's where she was in prison. Yeah.
Okay. And it's like, this is like Oscar winner Charlize Theron doesn't even have a line of dialogue in the trailer, as far as I remember. And she's just part of this massive immersive franchise. You know, the selling point is the action. The selling point is the action with the cars. I think Justin Lin does a really good job of dialing into, like, if you're this far along in the Fast and Furious franchise, like, you're bought into what they can
physics
do
physics don't matter. I will say that video that he released of the car going through the building into what I'm assuming there's like a magnet in the truck. Okay, that's awesome. That was even asshole skeptical me will go, yeah, that's really cool. Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, like, I feel like it's really cool. One, Justin Lin continues shooting this franchise on film. He shoots partially on film for these films. Also,
which is astounding, because you would think that this would be a franchise where, like, you would want to. Though I guess if you think, like, a lot of these stunts, I'd imagine you really only get one take on, right? Like, how many chances do you get for, like, for that car ripping through the building? How many shots do you get at that? I guess I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm just thinking about, like, the multiple takes versus one take thing.
Well, look, go back to, like, Furious Fast 6 or whatever. Remember the cars were hitting other cars and flipping up? Like, the behind the scenes on how they did this, they put, like, some kind of tube thing for the car to hit it and flip perfectly. I mean, at the end of the day, like, I understand that people have criticisms about the Fast franchise, but the work that goes into the action in these films is astounding. Like, and at the end of the day, I think that's, you know, I care about the characters, so I'm immersed into it where it enhances the action for me. It's, at the end of the day, when it comes to Fast and Furious, as much as I love the action scenes, I love the non-action scenes too. So I'm like I watched Furious 7 last night, and there's a great scene where Vin Diesel goes to visit The Rock in the hospital after The Rock gets destroyed by Statham. And I love that exchange. I love their dialogue. And as cheesy as the lines may be, or like, there's like a line where he's talking to a character, he goes, words haven't even been invented yet, about how he's going to get revenge on somebody. I mean, I don't mind that. I think
can't pronounce them, Kevin.
No, it's not it. I actually find it awesome. It's like a high-end, I guess, quote-unquote soap opera, if you want to call it that, with incredible
action. Yeah, for sure it's a soap opera. Yes.
And I don't mind that. And I think, isn't Star Wars a soap opera, too? I mean, like,
but it's in space.
Pronounced space opera.
Space opera.
Kev, do you think that John Cena will have the same impact that The Rock had when he joined the franchise?
Well, it's a different character. I what I find interesting about Cena's character is the Toretto connection. And one of the things I find interesting about the way they're positioning this character is Dom keeps calling him little brother.
Yeah.
There's, I have a feeling there's a bigger story there than just this is simply Dominic Toretto's brother. I think there's going to be a whole explanation for it as to why we haven't heard about this character for a long time, because they have to play into that, right? Like, we're 20 years into the franchise. Why haven't we heard about this guy?
Something that I also forgot too when I was writing up the trailer story. Jordana Brewster is Dom's sister, so it's his. It's her brother too.
You don't remember the tuna sandwich scene from the first movie? It's incredible.
Totally forgot. Dude, totally forgot.
I could quote the first movie. Like, anyways, but I know we'll move on. I'm very excited about this movie. I wish The Rock was in it, because I think that he really kind of elevated the franchise. I Fast Five and Fast and Furious Seven are my two favorites, and then one, obviously. But there are scenes in this franchise that are some of my favorite action scenes of all time. And that shot that Jake's referring to, people go to Justin Lin's Twitter. It was an 8-month prep. It took them, 4 days to shoot it or something, and they destroyed 3 cars just to get a 4-second shot.
It's really cool. It's really cool shot.
It's dedication. I mean, yeah. And I think at the end of the day, you have to appreciate the filmmaking. Also, sure. Justin Lin, I'll mention one more thing. I think this is really cool. When I was in college, I studied that movie Better Luck Tomorrow, which I think we've all seen on here, right? Better Luck Tomorrow. Gabe, have you seen it?
So,
no, Justin Lin's like breakout really movie. So I don't know if people know this. This is probably more common known than I think. But the actor who plays Han, is that Sung Kang?
Sung Kang, yeah.
So Sung Kang's character in Better Luck Tomorrow is the same Han that exists in Fast and Furious.
Yes.
And so Better Luck Tomorrow is essentially a prequel to Fast and Furious.
Yes.
So, and what's really cool about it is Justin Lin got to carry that character over. So it's literally the same character. It's not just the name is the same. It's the same character, the same actor playing him. And I think it's really cool. If people out there are fans of Justin Lin and you haven't seen Better Luck Tomorrow, go back and watch that, and then watch, obviously, Han's return in this movie, because Justice for Han was a big thing on social media. People want this character back. I'm very excited he's back. And anybody who's like, okay, he died and now he's coming back, Michelle Rodriguez's character did the same thing, and I loved her return. So
you're right. Tokyo Drift takes place after 6, doesn't it? I think it's after 6 before 7.
Right. Let me get the exact Fast and Furious.
All right. While you're doing that, we're going to shift over to our Paramount Shuffle dates, which are very much focused on Tom Cruise, because he has 3 huge blockbusters coming and we just never get a chance to ever see them. Top Gun moved from July 2nd to November 19th. And we'll get to Mission Impossible in a second, but I want to point that one out first, because I think it's not a huge mistake. Like, people are going to go see it whenever they go see it. But like, July feels like it's going to be as safe as it's going to be for the, and like, unless things reverse, you know, or some of these variants come around, and a movie like that coming out over the course of the July 4th holiday just seemed like it was tailor made for Tom Cruise to bring Top Gun back, especially that movie. And so moving it back to November 19th gives it no real significance. Like, I don't see the point of Top Gun Maverick, you know, hitting in November 19th.
Do you see how terribly poetic the movie that replaced that slot is?
No, what moved into the slot?
I believe it's the new Purge movie.
Oh, is it really?
So it was Purge.
But Purge movies have a history of tying to the 4th of July and like they kind of do. Being about America.
Yeah.
And
they had one. Yeah, yeah.
And they.
But it's such a different connotation.
I have the chronological order, by the way, just to clarify. Just to take right. So the Fast and the Furious, that's the first one. This is chronologically. That's one. Too Fast, Too Furious. Then Fast and Furious, which is the fourth one, which is technically 3.
Right.
Then they go to 5, then 6, then 3, then 7, then 8, then 9. You have to give them credit for building that world and keeping that together. That's pretty insane. And you have to give them a little credit for that.
I don't think they did that much work for it.
I actually think they did.
They had a reboot.
Really cool.
They had a reboot in the middle of their thing. Like, the reason that that's that way is because they had 3, and then 4, they were like, let's reboot it, and because we wanted, like...
Yeah, but if you go back and watch at the end of 6, when they tie Statham back into 3, and then Dom goes to visit the actor who played the lead in 3.
But it's not Kevin Feige, like,
I know. Like, they're retconning because they realize that they messed up. Like, so I don't feel like that's something you really get.
I think they're just playing around with it. I think I think it's cool. But I don't think
you get a pat on the back like you do with Marvel.
And Helen Mirren, by the way, was out of prison in 8. She visits Dom in that, like, or one of the characters in that bar. She's in prison in Hobbs and Shaw.
Sorry. Gotcha. Anybody else agree that Top Gun should have stayed?
Because that would have been great to, because yeah, like we're kind of already back in a world where, you know, Godzilla's opening big at the box office, you know, and people are showing they're willing to, and it's only going to get, in theory, hopefully, fingers crossed, as people get vaccinated, it's only going to get better.
This was the one delay that made me scratch my head. It didn't make any sense because we especially when they delayed it, which like what, last week, I think was when that came out, because you're right, Jake, it's like Godzilla vs. Kong is on its way to $500 million, whatever it's going to make. It's already well over 300, almost close to 400 million worldwide, crushed in the United States, even with an HBO Max option.
Yeah, people have the option. Amazing.
You would think that by July, especially with how many Americans have been vaccinated by this point, that we would be in a space where a movie like Top Gun, even if it doesn't play in full 100% capacity theaters, it could still open over 3,000 theaters, probably close to 4,000, and maybe do them 50% each, whatever it is. I'm trying to understand why Tom Cruise would move out of the summer. It doesn't make any sense to me because I feel like we're at a time where it's almost like Top Gun could be that movie for everybody, right?
It only had 1 week. It was only
That's what I wonder. Was that the Black Widow shuffle? Black Widow moved to July 9th.
Oh, then that makes sense. Oh, wait, so you think? Do you think?
Wait, Black Widow opens July 9th?
Yeah,
Black Widow.
Widow forced the Top Gun move?
I think that would make a little sense. That they didn't want to move forward. Well, because Fast is right there. Now they're wedged between F9 and Black Widow. Oh,
so F9's June 25th. So that gets 2 weeks.
Yep.
That makes sense because that's the thing. I think this is the underrated topic of conversation that we haven't really dived into as much is the shuffle and how it messed up all the IMAX releases. Yeah. Because these IMAX releases, they get very specific windows. And isn't that kind of what happened with Godzilla? They moved Mortal Kombat so they could give Godzilla more time in IMAX.
Kombat went back 1 week.
Right. So I think one of the things I'm really interested in, it has to be this. This has to be the answer as to why Top Gun moved. Because Top Gun deserves a 2 or 3 week IMAX run, for sure. I mean,
yeah,
I'm so excited
for that movie.
And in a weird way, I feel like Tom Cruise would be like, we only have a week in IMAX? Yeah, we got to move this thing. We barely, because if you said Fast and Furious is June 25th,
then Top Gun would have been July 2nd.
I don't know if this would at all be a part of it, but you know, I think we had all sort of heard some rumblings about like potential press opportunities that were going to be happening around Top Gun, even this summer. And you know, a Tom Cruise movie does not come out without Tom Cruise kind of going balls to the wall when it comes to press and sort of what he did, not just doing press, but like really go. I mean, the last time we all spoke to him was in the shadow of the Eiffel Tower in Paris. And how much of it do you think is, you know, this is a guy who is now famous for being Mr. COVID protocol, you know, and you can't turn around and then hold this big, giant, splashy premiere like we all kind of heard was going to be happening. Is there any chance that a part of it was like, hey, let's push it back so we can really do what we want to do in terms of the promotional angle of it?
Here's what I hope they do.
It just makes sense to come out in July, though. It just makes sense.
Oh, no, I agree with you.
I hope that they make you guys try to ask him questions while doing barrel rolls in like an F-16.
I would actually
just puking, trying
to
say, so Mr. Cruise,
done it, man. Prepped. Rode the Thunderbirds.
Yeah, true. You have. All right. So by pushing this back for all the reasons that we just sort of brought up, this also affects Tom Cruise's other franchise, which is Mission Impossible. And so now MI7 goes from November 19th, which now has the Top Gun date, all the way back to May 26th, 2022. It is Memorial Day of 2022. And then brace for it, kids. Mission Impossible 8, which I believe this is a two-part story.
Yeah. Oh, God, it's going to leave off on such a cool cliffhanger.
Is going to go from... So you're going to get MI7 on May 26th, 2022. You're going to get MI8 on July 7th, 2023.
I'm so excited!
You're excited? I'm sad to hear that.
Oh, no, I'm just excited. I'm just excited that this... I get jacked over that franchise, man. I get freaking jacked.
I know. That series is tremendous. I'm glad that McQuarrie is doing it.
Yes. And he's a big part of the reason why I am jacked about it.
Sure. That for you is what Fast and Furious is for Kevin. Like you,
but
you
I also
can
love
understand.
Okay,
I love Mission
That's
Impossible.
That's interesting.
Though.
Yeah,
that's okay. Know what, you know what? That's yeah. actually a really good comparison because the Mission Impossible films have gotten. I don't want to use the word more ridiculous, but like have gotten a little bit more like crazy. And that's a really interesting. And I give it a lot of passes.
The Mission films are Fast and Furious-y. They are. They've become
yeah,
that.
Just good.
Gabe's ascended.
Incredible service to Rebecca Ferguson and the great members of the cast of
Simon
the Mission Impossible franchise.
Ben Rames.
How about There's the great some... members of the Fast and Furious cast? Kurt Russell, Helen Mirren.
Yeah, but do they show up?
Charlize.
Kurt Russell's amazing in the Fast and Mr. Nobody's one of my favorite characters in the Fast and Furious franchise.
Scott Eastwood.
I gotta be honest, up until this moment, I completely forgot Kurt Russell was in the Fast and Furious movie.
Dude, I love. Do you remember the scene in the seventh one when he brings Dom to like the lab area and he like offers him a Corona? I thought it was so good.
He offers him a Corona.
I love that moment.
You can have any beer you want as long as it's a Corona.
It's oh my god, I love that callback.
This is
I love
probably
that.
This is probably too easy. But Kevin, can you name the what are the characters played by Ludacris and Tyrese?
Oh, Ludacris.
No.
No. Tyrese is oh, I'm blanking now. Hold on. Oh my god, I'm blanking now.
Even I know what they are, and I didn't look.
Wait, no. I just watched Seven last night.
Because my point being, over the Hold course on. Of the movies, they have just been reduced to Ludacris and Tyrese.
Yes.
Yeah, but I mean, like. Yeah, sure. I mean, I can't name every single character in the franchise. I can tell you Dominic Toretto. I can tell you Brian. I can tell you, obviously, I can get all into like the main people, but like
Letty, yeah,
Letty obviously, yeah.
I don't know if I can. Well, I guess it's Hobbs. But
to be fair, I have trouble remembering all of your names, so you can't really knock me because I couldn't name a lot of Mission Impossible characters' names.
What is Rebecca Ferguson's character's name in Mission Impossible?
Rebecca Ferguson. Gabe.
Ironically,
it's Ludacris.
It's Ilsa.
Touché.
It's Ilsa. And I don't love Mission Impossible. You guys love Mission Impossible. I
well,
like
their names in the Fast and Furious franchise are Roman and Taj.
Roman
and
yeah, Taj. Yeah.
Okay. To answer your question. Roman. All right, let's get to this weekend movies. Right. There's a film called SAS Red Notice that's opening. Anyone seen it?
Mm.
Nope. Yeah, Jake's like, yep, there is. There's a Sebastian Stan romantic comedy called Monday.
Is this the one with his butt? Did you guys see this yesterday? No, I know. There's
media?
A reason why I said that. So
he
yesterday,
put on Instagram, didn't he?
I think the review should just end there. The one with his butt.
It was so. In my defense, it was a huge trending topic yesterday. So Sebastian Stan has a very niche audience, and he tweeted out. It's massive.
It's massive.
It's a niche, large audience. Is what
oh
I
my
mean.
God! Like, if you mention him on social media, it blows up.
That's what I'm saying, though. But my grandma doesn't know who he is. You know what I mean? Like he's found some strange. Like large fan base that's like it feels niche. Anyway, so he posts this photo on his Instagram of his butt, and that immediately becomes a trending topic on Twitter.
Like
that's
his bare butt, or like in like pants.
Yeah, no, it's for this movie. Like the only reason I know what this is because of his Instagram. It's kind of smart marketing, I guess. It's him like with a jacket on, and he opens it up, and he's like showing whoever is in front of him something clearly. And you just see his butt cheeks, and that's the photo. And that ended up being a massive trending topic just because he posted a picture of his butt. That's how like ridiculously famous he is. And that's the only reason I know what Monday is, to be honest with you.
That is not America's ass by any way, shape, or form. Thank you very much.
Oh, Chris Evans should have replied to that with that. Why would he have not done that?
Did you guys see the bit that Josh Horowitz did? Really smart.
The text. Josh Horowitz, if you're like, not to promote another, but Josh Horowitz is a really great interviewer and is actually an advocate supporter of this show, so I don't have a problem supporting his show. He does a lot of really great bits.
That bit was hilarious.
Yeah, it was great. Sean, explain it, because I talk over you.
Yeah, I do not tip my hat to any other podcast necessarily, but Josh is extremely talented, and he had Sebastian Stan and Anthony Mackie on promoting Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and he essentially asked both of them, if you each texted Chris Evans simultaneously, who would he respond to first? and they tried it during the show, and then Evans hit them up, I think he got Mackie first.
Yeah,
and then immediately replied to Sebastian Stan. But he recognized that he was definitely in a bit kind of thing.
Yeah,
And it played because really
didn't
well.
He text Stan like, "Sorry, Mackie got to me first."
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
So really that's clever, funny. Really funny. Anyway, so the last film that's opening this week is from earlier in the episode, which is Ben Wheatley's movie In the Earth, and it is it's fine. It's good. It's not necessarily my type of film. I appreciated it for what it is. It's definitely, he wrote it for in 15 days while he was in a pandemic, while he was in quarantine, did it as an exercise to essentially make sure that he was still being creative. It encapsulates a lot of, so there's a virus, but it's not called Corona. It's not called COVID-19. Or coronavirus. It's just something that has wiped out large portions of the popularity. And so people are trying to ease back into life, but they're under a lot of different protocols. And these scientists are at a station in the woods, and they have to get to a place for a reason that is not necessarily explained very well, but they have to traipse through the woods in order to get there. And while they are going through the woods, they encounter people who have taken to the woods during this virus outbreak and set up little lives for themselves in the woods. And of course, it's really bad for our scientist characters as they're trying to get through. It leans into how ominous a forest setting can be. It's beautifully shot. Ben Wheatley obviously knows how to film fantastically. We talked a bit in the interview, as you guys heard about, he uses strobe lights in a way because some of these people in the woods are using audio and strobe lighting in order to, like, there is a sort of witch legacy at place for the people in the woods. And so he explores a little bit of that. But it's definitely a film that you could just tell was shot under bizarre protocols. Like it's something he wanted to do to sort of flex his muscles in between big budget productions. He's coming off of Rebecca, the Netflix film that he did, and he's gearing up for The Meg 2. And so I'm going to treat it like that, like an experiment that he got together with a bunch of his friends and shot a micro budget horror film that looks great, but probably didn't hook me as well as he wanted it.
I have a question for you guys that I wanted to kind of pitch based on sort of the idea of him writing this during quarantine. You know, when the pandemic began, there was sort of this joke going on, right? That like Shakespeare wrote King Lear in the middle of a quarantine. So like, what are you going to do? What is your project that you're going to be? And there have been several projects that have come out of us being in pandemic, whether they're pandemic related or not, it's just a result of someone sitting down and writing. They're like, well, I'm stuck at home, so I might as well do something. What do you guys think is the best movie related thing to come out of to be the result of us being locked down for a year? Because my answer would probably be Host.
I have a ton to compare to.
There was the Anne Hathaway movie.
Yeah, lockdown. That was fine. I'm trying to think of. Yeah, probably. I mean, I'm trying to think of, I don't know any other.
I'm having a hard time thinking about other ones.
Malcolm and Marie was actually probably the best.
Yeah, that's a great answer too. Malcolm Marie is another one.
I don't know. Really good question. I'm not quite sure that I've seen it yet. I don't know that I've seen the one that's come out of, you know, everybody being locked down like this yet.
You say Host, Jake?
Yeah, I would say Host, but you guys know I love that movie.
Sean, did you happen to ask Ben his favorite cereal?
Ben Wheaties?
Yes, I was going to say Wheatley's.
I rarely get them, so it's always a great source of pride for me.
That's a good one.
Wheatley's.
For those of you who aren't watching on YouTube, you're really missing a moment right now.
All right, this week's blend game.
I'm so happy you got that.
It was right away, too.
It was great.
This is Oscar Isaac blend, the wonderful, talented Oscar Isaac. Kev, I'm going to start with you. What'd you go with for your pick for your favorite Oscar Isaac film?
I have a hard time believing that all three of us are going to pick anything different than what I'm about to say.
Okay.
Are you serious, Jake? Really? Okay. I mean, I feel like the ultimate. Oh, I know what Jake's going to say. All right, Jake's going to go with something. I'm going to write this down. I'm going to write this down. I don't want to give it away. And then I'm going to prove that I knew it before we get to it.
I hope you're writing down The Last Jedi.
This actually might be Jake's. This might be Jake's and Sean's answer, actually.
Oh, interesting.
All right, I've written it down. I'm putting the paper top of my coffee cup.
All right.
My choice is Ex Machina, only because clearly the dance is one of the greatest things that's ever happened to cinema. It's genuinely iconic. It is one of the greatest moments in cinema history. I love that scene. I also think that movie's just brilliant. Thematically, dramatically, character arc-wise, I think him and Donald Gleeson are phenomenal in that film. Alicia Vikander is incredible in that movie. That movie is so much better than it really deserved to be, considering the budget's lower, and it felt big. Her effects were incredible. But going back to Oscar Isaac specifically, there's just something about that character that really struck me. It really, to me, was the defining moment. I was like, that guy is a phenomenal actor.
Yep.
You know, he's obviously been in the Star Wars franchise. You know, clearly people know who he is from that. But to be honest with you, the moment I watched Ex Machina was the moment I realized that Oscar Isaac had insane talent. So I am all in on him, whatever he wants to do in terms of performing, because Ex Machina was my, like, it, I became a fan when I watched Ex Machina. So that's my go-to, no question. Like when this got posed the other week about, our favorite Oscar Isaac movie, it's the only one that came to mind. So that's, I mean, everyone I feel like has already seen it. We all know the dance gif you posted on your Twitter today, Sean. So Ex Machina, no question. And, that's mine. So I think I know both of yours.
Well, now I got to go to Jake to see if it lives up to what Kevin wrote down.
I'm going with Inside Llewyn Davis. There it
that
is.
That is also my choice.
Yeah. I knew it. I was dead on.
Well done. I chose it. And I'll just talk a little bit because I want Sean to talk on it as well. And
not Force Awakens? I'm really surprised.
No. Well, here's why.
Okay.
Whenever I choose my blend picks, it's got to be a combination of performance and then also like the quality of the movie and also their impact on the movie.
Okay.
And I feel like Inside Llewyn Davis is the perfect blend for all three of those.
Yep.
I think it's I think it's his best performance. I think it's a better performance than Ex Machina. And I think Inside Llewyn Davis depends more on him. Like that movie anchors, is anchored upon him, you know? And I genuinely love that movie. I've always loved this idea of this movie because it's so much of the antithesis of like Chasing Your Dreams movie. Because so much of like the Chasing Your Dreams movies are like, if you work hard enough and you struggle and you fight, you'll get there and you'll succeed. And what I always loved about this Coen Brothers movie is like, sometimes you don't. Like not there are a lot of people that want it really bad. And a lot of people that scrape and fight and struggle and do everything you're supposed to do, everything the movies tell you to do. And then sometimes you just don't make it. That's just how life is. In a lot of ways, yeah.
Yep.
And so I love that movie. I actually think it's weirdly, Daenerys loves it. I think it's a weirdly underrated Coen Brothers movie. I think the worst thing they have going against them is they make too many consistently good movies so that a good one just kind of gets lost in the wake like this one.
Yeah.
But yeah, I couldn't, as much as I love Ex Machina and even as much as I do love him in The Force Awakens and even the other Star Wars films, I couldn't pick anything over Inside Llewyn Davis.
It's a great choice, though. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a phenomenal film.
And I feel the same way about Ex Machina.
So good. It's very good.
Yeah.
Ex Machina is terrific. I almost went with also a film that he did with Jessica Chastain called The Most Violent Year.
Oh, it's a great movie.
Mm.
Terrific film that does not get the attention that it deserves. And so if people haven't seen that movie, please check it out. But Jake's so right about Llewyn Davis. I went with it because it's largely at rest on his shoulders. He rises to the challenge. This is much like what Kevin was saying with the Ex Machina. This is the one where when I watched him, I was just like, oh my God, this guy's got it. Like, he's just that good. He obviously plays guitar and sings in this as well too. And is so incredibly talented. And there is a scene that I will always, I'll never forget it. It might be one of the most impactful scenes in a Coen Brothers movie, which is when he gets finally to this club that he's been, you know, on this sojourn to get to. It's incredibly powerful emotional journey, and he plays the song for the guy, and it ends up being like, it's such a pivotal point of that movie because you're on this journey with him, and so when he gets the chance to audition, you're like, well, the song better be amazing. And then he plays it, and there's even a moment where he sort of takes a breath, like a beat right before, and I like to think, because I rewatched it, that he like changed his mind and thought like, I was going to play something, but now I'm going to play something else and I'm going to play it from my heart. and he plays this song, and it's truly an incredible song, and he's amazing in it. And at the end, the guy just says, like, I don't see any money in this. And that is such the cynical Joel and Ethan Coen answer, you know, to an artist who is...
It's F. Murray Abraham, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, an artist has just bared their soul, and the industry turns around and is just like, I don't see a lot of money in this, which I'm sure the Coens have been told numerous times. And so, yeah, it's weird that Llewyn Davis is kind of an underrated Coens film. People don't... I feel like it gets mentioned a decent amount, but like it's not
nowadays
up there with like Lebowski
within
and
film
others.
Twitter it does, but outside of like
for sure
it's nowhere near the stratosphere of like a Lebowski or a Fargo or No Country for Old Men or even like Oh Brother Where Art Thou.
Yeah,
if you had to say what is the definitive Coen Brothers movie?
Fargo.
You wouldn't say Lebowski.
I would say Fargo. I think. As many people as do love Lebowski, I also feel like it's still a bit of an acquired taste. I feel like Fargo is much more accessible. And also that dark style of humor,
it's one
I feel
of those
like
too.
Represents... I mean, No Country for Old Men, even though it's like their Oscar film, that's so much darker than what they normally... Normally their stuff has a sense of humor.
No Country for Old Men is the best movie they've made, though.
Yes.
I actually would agree with that upon a rewatch I had recently.
Yeah. Yes. I recently rewatched Blood Simple.
Oh, really?
Oh.
God. It's so cool to see an early film like that and then just see the seeds that... And I mean, Fargo is birthed from Blood Simple. Like, just like violence, you know, from coming from misunderstandings. And just, it's fantastic.
Fargo is devastating, by the way. Like the path that H. Macy goes down in that movie, and just the hole just keeps getting deeper and deeper, and it just mounting, and you feel that. That's so great.
My favorite piece of trivia coming out of that movie is, I guess, the year that it came out, because it starts with the title card that like this really happened, which it didn't. Mm. It's a fictional story, but I guess that year there were a lot of people who thought that it really happened. Also, there really wasn't. Like, the internet wasn't as big of a thing, so you couldn't automatically get on the internet and see that, you know. And I guess people actually went out and were, like, looking for the money.
Oh, really?
Because the money is left out there.
Right.
And so I guess, people actually went out looking for the money, thinking that it was a real story.
Mm. Fargo is one of those movies that I did not like the first time I watched it.
Oh, interesting.
I absolutely had to warm up to it and figure out what it... And I think largely because, like, you're almost supposed to be annoyed by the characters a lot of times. And so I was deeply annoyed by the characters. And I was like, I don't want to spend any more time with them. So
Sean, what would you... To Kevin's question, what would you say is the definitive Coen Brothers movie? Not the best, but the definitive.
I feel like I'm going to show somebody Big Lebowski before I show them anything else.
Really?
I feel like it's either Lebowski or Fargo. I feel like it's down to those two. The only reason why I might go Lebowski is because they have such a deep tie to Jeff Bridges.
Just Lebowski has everything the Coen brothers
have They have a deep tie to Frances McDormand, too.
Well, one of them does.
Isn't Joel married to her?
Yeah, right? That's my point. Yeah.
No,
so
I know
Gabe,
what
would you say?
Yeah.
I can't believe I'm on an island by myself thinking it's Fargo.
I don't know. Fargo's not a bad answer at all.
It's a
great answer. Yeah.
It's one of those two. Yeah, you guys are right. I think it depends on... They're pretty multifaceted. So if we're going with definitive, where it's like... If we were doing the two-film challenge that we do on Real Blood,
we would pick those two.
We would pick those two.
Yeah.
But what's the one you would show to somebody to show who the Coen brothers are?
If I were to pick one, I would pick Lebowski because I think it would... But again, this is a different context than quote unquote definitive. I would think if I showed them Lebowski, I could easily convince them to watch another one. You know what I mean?
Good point.
But you know what? That's very strips away. I think them and Clooney are fantastic. Like I.
Well, you just got to keep on.
Yeah, but I would also argue that them and Clooney have only made one good movie.
Oh, I love
Burn After Reading.
I love Burn After Reading.
Intolerable
also,
Cruelty.
Too. I love Intolerable
Cruelty.
I
love
Cruelty.
Burn After Reading.
I've tried.
Burn After Reading feels like a short film.
Yeah, I like Burn After Reading. I love Oh Brother Where Art Thou. I have tried to convince myself that I like Intolerable Cruelty.
Was it intolerable?
It's not. I just and I kind of I like his character in it. I think his character is fun to watch.
Yeah.
And then Hail Caesar. I couldn't get myself.
Oh, I like Hail Caesar.
I love Hail Caesar.
I've rewatched the scene. I think one of their best scenes is the scene between Alden Ehrenreich and Ralph Fiennes, where he can't pronounce a tour that is not so simple. Yeah. And he can't he's like, what are you doing with your hands? Put your hands down. Put your hands down. Like, that is just brilliant.
Well, yeah, I think Intolerable Cruelty is in the same boat. Sorry, Sean. In same boat as Lady Killers.
No. I was just going to say Lady Killers is the one that I can't watch at all. Ooh. And I think Intolerable Cruelty is.
Which is weird because Hanks has such a great eye and ear for comedy. And you would think he would fit into a cult. I wish they'd give him another shot because Lady Killers ain't
I
it.
I wish they would. Yeah, I wish they
he
would.
He had to be a certain kind of actor to work with the Coens, I think.
I think Tom Hanks could do it.
I think Tom Hanks might be... weirdly enough too famous to be it's such I know it's a strange comment but because like he's they've had famous people in their movies obviously but I
would you know I've got more to say about this actually
I would watch
we
Inside
started this
Larry
discussion
Crown.
With Oscar Isaac I want you to know. We're still on Oscar Isaac
all right
I mean Llewyn Davis brought us here makes sense
Jeff Maimon Guy Anthony and several others went with Inside Llewyn Davis Michael Breen threw some love toward Triple Frontier chose Ridley Scott's Robin Hood, which I didn't even realize that he was in. And Experiment 13 went with Zack Snyder's Sucker Punch. Thank you very much for everybody
wait,
who participated.
He said Robin Hood? Nobody said Ex Machina?
Oh, I'm sorry. Wait. Yeah. Hold on. I cut that off. Hold on.
I was like, what?
Kevin McCarthy did.
Someone named Zen Jake said Ex Machina.
Well, thank you, Zen Jake. I appreciate that. I'm actually surprised I'm the only one.
For next week, someone who I swore we did, but apparently we have not done before. Hashtag Michael Giacchino blend. Good luck to you guys choosing
Wait,
your favorite Michael Giacchino blend.
We have done him
blend.
Before.
No, you've just
Gabe
interviewed him on the show before.
We did interview him on the show. Yes,
Gabe. Can I ask your favorite Coen or your favorite
Oscar,
Oscar
like
Isaac movie?
Oscar, I would like to know your favorite Oscar
oh,
Isaac.
Oh, I didn't look into this. I'm gonna miss one. I want to say. Wow, you know, he doesn't count
look,
for Annihilation,
look
does
at
he?
The, look, no, he does not. He's,
no.
Is he I mean, if any of the other two guys were to say Annihilation, I'd be like, is, really?
I revisited Annihilation. It's better than I remembered.
It's
is
fantastic.
He Natalie Portman's husband?
Yes.
Yeah, he comes back and he's all messed up.
But he's fantastic.
Oh, right.
I would probably say Ex Machina. I love that movie.
Yeah.
Clearly, okay. I love Alex Garland.
So for next week, Michael Giacchino blend. You can use social media or you can email us at realblend@cinemablend.com. Drop us a review there as well, too. No review this week, but you can go to Apple Podcasts if you want to leave us a review of the show, positive or negative. We will promise to read it here on the show. It helps us grow out the Real Blend army, obviously, and keep people listening to the show. Make sure you share with a movie-loving friend or family member and tell them about Real Blend because we have a whole backlog of episodes that they can listen to, a whole catalog of things you can get into, as well as a back catalog of Real Blend premium episodes. Our next one is going to be special movie theaters that we have visited, and I think we're going to share a couple of Arclight stories as well, too, based on the fact that that might not be coming back, but we'll see.
I like this topic.
Sign up for the Real Blend premium at going to bit.ly/realblendpremium, and we'll be back next week with a full-on new episode. Until then, follow Jake at Jake's Takes. Follow Kevin at Kevin McCarthy TV. Give me a follow at Sean_O'Connell. And Gabe Kovach is at Gabe Kovach, right? Yeah, perfect. And at Real Blend. See you next week. Bye, guys.
Hubie.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.